All right, thanks for coming today. My name is Brian. I'm going to talk to you about YCSB. I would like to say, first of all, thank you very much for this honor. We're very honored by this award, and we're just super grateful that people found what we did useful and that they were able to use it in their own work over the years. We also have Adam and Rusty here. So thanks for coming at 8:30 a.m. on a Saturday. I know the reason you're really here is to find out how you, too, can write a paper that 10 years from now wins an award. So if that's all you're here for, I've got one slide for you. Here's my guide to writing a paper that is widely cited. Number one, pick an area that is new and hot, right, that a lot of people are working in. And then number two, discover that no one knows how to measure anything in that area, that they've got systems that they're building, but they don't know what the right metrics are. Number three, come up with something sort of halfway reasonable. Okay, it doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be good. And then number four, make it easy for people to use. And then suddenly you're off to the races. So that's essentially what we did. In some sense, we were kind of in the right place at the right time because we were working in an area that people wanted to measure, but there wasn't really a standard way of doing it. So looking back 10 years ago, how this all started, it kind of all started actually with sort of a semi-funny story. So Raghu, who was our boss, Raghu Ramakrishnan, was invited to give a talk at VLDB, okay, which is great. A keynote talk at VLDB is a massive opportunity. He was already super famous, but that's okay. And so he came to us, he said, I want to give this talk about our system that we're building, Peanuts, and compare it to the rest of the cloud storage systems at the time, and sort of look at the trade-offs and the performance differences between them. So he came to us and he said, all right, guys, let's see the data that shows our system is fast, right? We've been working on this thing for a while. We think it's fast. Show me the data. And we're like, oh, sorry, Reg. We don't really have any experiments because at the time, there wasn't really a good benchmark that compared systems of this flavor. You know, you could run experiments on your own system, and you could show that your system scaled with the number of machines or the amount of records or whatever, but there wasn't sort of a standard way of comparing different things, okay? So, you know, if you think about what the world looked like at that time, this was 10 years ago in the database world, there was sort of this big change going on, right? Like systems had been SQL systems and transactional systems for so many years, but people were sort of getting away from that. And they were looking at these NoSQL systems that, you know, by the name implying, didn't have the SQL language, but also didn't have that whole kind of interaction model of strong transactions and, you know, declarative query languages. They were moving towards these systems that were called NoSQL, like Google's Bigtable, HBase, Cassandra, and other things. And also at the time, we were looking at systems that were living in the cloud. So instead of running your own database system yourself, on-premise, in your own servers, you would sort of rent the database system from someone else. So our own system, Peanuts, was like this. Amazon had some, and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of options. There was a lot of different new things you could do to manage your data. But the industry as a whole and the research community as a whole didn't have a lot of experience with any of these things, okay? So there was a lot of, we think this is going to be better, we think this is going to be faster, but no real data yet at the time. Something similar was happening inside of Yahoo at that time, okay? So Yahoo, at the time, was a very large and powerful internet company, and they had storage systems, right, that were big and scalable, but they weren't exactly the kind of storage systems that met all their needs. For example, they were not very consistent. There was a concurrency model that was sort of best effort for many of these systems. They would try to replicate your data, and if they failed, sorry, right? So they wanted something better at different product groups in Yahoo, and they were looking at different options. They were looking at the system that we were building called Peanuts. Internally, it was called Sherpa. But of course, they were evaluating other systems as well, Cassandra, HBase, and so on. And although we thought that our system was the best, right, we couldn't just show up and say, hey, we have PhDs, we know better, we use our system, right? We couldn't do that. We had to actually show them data or show them some experiments that demonstrated that for their workload, the system that we were building was going to be the one that they wanted. So we decided to be scientific about it and be a little rigorous, okay? So how would you do that, right? So if you want to scale up a Yahoo user database, this is sort of an interesting story that we found fascinating at the time. We would go to these database systems inside of Yahoo that existed and say, okay, how does it work? And they would explain it to us and say, oh, here's a cluster of database systems, and this cluster has 128 machines in it. And we're like, okay, that's pretty big, but what if you wanted to be bigger? What if Yahoo grows in scale? And they're like, okay, all you have to do is double the number of machines. Okay, then you give, you know, 256 machines, and if you wanted to grow it again, it had to be 512 machines. The whole thing is based on powers of two. So every time you grew it a little bit, you actually had to double it, which is not going to be sustainable because it's literally exponentially costly to increase the size of this thing. So We wanted a system that was a little bit more sort of incrementally scalable, where you could add one machine or five machines instead of having double it each time. Okay, so we're database researchers, so at the time, the standard way of comparing database systems was TPC something, right? TPCW or TPCH, something like that. The systems we wanted to compare didn't really fit into those models, right? TPC benchmarks were all based on SQL. They're all based on a very relational, kind of strict transactional model. The systems that we were comparing were NoSQL systems and didn't really have the underlying concurrency model that matched exactly what TPC wanted, okay? The other thing is that a lot of the web workloads that we were looking at were kind of different from the standard one that TPC had. So at the time, there was like TPCW, which was like an online shopping benchmark, but there was a lot of other web applications that had different workloads that weren't going to fit into that sort of TPCW model. So there was no benchmark at the time that was standard that really made sense. And as a result, a lot of these groups that were building database systems turned to another way of measuring their system, which was to write blog posts. So at the time, there was a lot of blog posts from different groups, like Cassandra is awesome for the following reasons, HBase is awesome for the following reasons, and each of these blog posts would have some data in it. They would have a graph showing, you know, some experiments they ran, but there was no way to sort of compare between them. You know, if you read every blog post, you would sort of come away thinking that every system was equally awesome, and there was no way to figure out what the trade-offs were between them. And we actually had this experience where we would talk to a product team inside of Yahoo, and we would say, hey, you know, we think you should use our system. And they're like, oh, we're going to go with Cassandra. We're like, okay, why? And they're like, well, we read this blog post, and it had this number, you know, this graph in it was like this. So, you know, we wanted something a little bit better than that, than just comparing blog posts. So we thought about it a bit, and we realized that for these systems, of course, just like any benchmarking situation, you know, the question wasn't entirely specified. Which system is fastest is not the right question. So you have to figure out exactly what you want to measure. You know, are you worried about the cost of reads, or are you worried about the cost of writes? Are you talking about workloads that have large scans, where you're scanning lots of data, or just point operations, where you're reading and writing a single record at a time? Were you caring about primarily throughput and latency, or were you just concerned with scalability, elasticity? And we found that none of these by themselves is exactly enough. We wanted to kind of figure out the trade-offs between all of these for the different systems. So some systems are going to be optimized for reads, but not so for writes, or vice versa. Some systems are going to be very good for scans, but not necessarily for point reads. And so what we wanted was a benchmark that allowed you to kind of poke at the boundaries of all these systems and figure out what their trade-offs were. So instead of having sort of a single number that says our system is faster or not faster, it would allow you to kind of figure out which workloads would work for this system or that system and compare them that way. So we decided to build something. What we wanted to do was to define a set of workloads that roughly approximated web serving workloads, okay? We didn't want to have sort of a super high fidelity, you know, trace of operations that we captured from Yahoo Mail or something like that. First of all, because we couldn't necessarily share that outside of Yahoo, but secondly, because we weren't, you know, looking at what a single application would do on a database, but sort of what a range of applications would do. And so we wanted to have a set of workloads that kind of picked different workloads in the web space. And then we wanted to put those exact same workloads on different systems. So as much as possible, have the whole infrastructure be the same, except for the database underneath would be different, right? So you could actually kind of get an apples-to-apples comparison of two database systems where all the other degrees of freedom were fixed. And we wanted to draw some pretty graphs so we could get a paper published in this lovely conference, of course. And the result was this benchmark that we developed, the Yahoo Cloud Serving Benchmark. Okay, so I've got to show an architecture slide because I'm a database person, but actually the software is not all that complex. This is the benchmarking tool. The red thing in the middle is the thing that we built. There's a workload executor which would take in a specification file of what the workload was. This was a mix, you know, what is the mix of reads and writes? How big are the records? What does the data set look like? And this workload executor would take the specification and spit out a series of reads and writes against the database. And those reads and write operations would be picked up by these client threads that would actually execute them. So a real web application, right, has lots and lots of servers. We wanted to make this as easy as possible to run, so we said you can run a single process and it'll just have a lot of threads in it, and that'll roughly approximate multiple servers talking to the database. And then those threads would take these operations from the workload executor and actually call API calls in the DB client, which would call out to the database. Now, we tried to make this system as extensible as possible so that people could use it for different things. We explicitly defined two kinds of extensibility. One was you could define new workloads. Like we had a standard set of workloads that we talked about in the paper, but if you had a kind of workload that we hadn't described, you could either tweak the parameters in the workload file, or you could actually re-implement the Java class in the workload executor to do something interesting. So for example, we had like a uniform distribution of requests and a Zipf-in distribution of requests, but you might want something like Poisson or something. You could simply just write that code. And then the second way that it was extensible was that you could implement this database client to plug in new clients for new database systems, okay? So the database client was just a Java abstract class, right, that had a very simple CRUD interface, so like insert, update, read, delete. And you could implement those operations by calling out to actual API calls of your database, okay? So this is what we did in the paper. We had one for Cassandra that made Cassandra API calls. We had one for HBase and so on. It turns out that over the years, the second thing is the main place where people have extended the tool, okay? So there's now something like 50 different databases that YCSB can measure using stuff checked into the GitHub repository. And this makes sense, right? Like the main value of the tool is to be able to compare different database systems. So the main way that people have extended the system is to provide more backends that it can call out to, okay? All right, so we took this tool, we defined a set of workloads. We were extraordinarily clever in our naming scheme. We called them like A, B, C, and D, right? No, we weren't that creative. But they represented different points in the workload spectrum, okay? So we had a read-heavy workload, we had an update-heavy workload, we had one that involved short ranges, and we were trying to sort of figure out different ways that people might put load on these systems and try to map these workloads to kind of canonical web applications. So for example, the read-heavy workload sort of modeled one in which you had photos and you were putting tags on the photos, and every once in a while there'd be a write to add a new tag, but most of what you were doing is reading the existing tags and displaying them on the web. So that's like a read-heavy workload. As a part of this workload definition, we tried to make the workloads actually relatively simple so that there was a high degree of confidence that you could actually run them on different database systems. If the workloads depended too much on any sort of clever feature of any particular database system, you wouldn't necessarily be able to generalize it and compare across database systems. So that's part of the reason that the workloads were relatively simple. We acknowledge, of course, at the time and now even, that real workloads are going to be much more interesting than these, and so the numbers you get here are sort of just a first approximation of the results that you'll get. So we took these workloads, we took our tool, we drew some graphs. The actual numbers on this graph are completely irrelevant to you because they're 10 years old and no, they don't represent the current performance of these systems anymore, but I wanted to show it to you to sort of demonstrate the kinds of trade-offs we were trying to get at. So this is our write-heavy workload. As you can see, some of the systems scaled pretty nicely with the write-heavy workload, and some of them hit a wall, right, where after a certain throughput, they just couldn't give you any more performance. At the same time, we had a different workload, which was based on read-heavy. Okay, this is mostly read operations. And you can see that the trade-off changes. The systems now that hit the cliff in the write-heavy workload were actually much more scalable in the read-heavy workload. And this is exactly the kind of trade-off we were trying to get at, that, you know, you can't claim that your system is good at everything because that's just not going to be the way it is, but you can figure out sort of the points in the workload space where it does better or it does worse. Okay? All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about lessons that we learned, or at least that I personally learned from this experience. Lesson number one is that tools can be as valuable as new systems or techniques. Okay? So I, you know, as a database researcher, my number one goal in life was to invent the next big database algorithm, right? Like the system that's going to give us some exciting new, you know, database performance. And it was really sort of surprising to me that one of our most successful papers was not a database technique or a new join algorithm or a streaming SQL whatever, right? Was actually just a tool that people could use to measure their systems. And that's, you know, that actually has informed a lot of the work that I've done since. If you can make something that is useful to people, that may be as useful or more as some super clever algorithm. So, funny story number three, we're all here accepting an award for this paper, and we really appreciate that, but the paper is, in fact, almost irrelevant, right? Like, the most important thing is the tool, okay? So, I don't know if anybody actually even reads the text of the paper anymore because the numbers are so old and it doesn't matter, but the tool has been so useful to people because it's allowed them to get their own measurements of their own systems, which is great. And I think that the reason that the tool was so successful was not necessarily because it was the most brilliant benchmark ever, but because it was easy to use. It was easy to extend. It was open source. You could download it and get it running. Like, I've had emails from, you know, people at universities and corporations, but also people in high school that are like, I'm doing this project, you know, can I use this thing? And they download it and they run it and they get some numbers in a few minutes, and that's pretty good. So, of course, you can do more sophisticated benchmarking. You can have more interesting workloads and so on, but the fact that the tool is something that you can download and use and run so easily, I think is the main reason it's been useful. Okay, so second lesson learned. Not everybody in the world is purely motivated by scientific curiosity, so we ran into a few people that were a little shocked that we were even doing this work. In hindsight, I think I can actually reframe this lesson as researchers, we didn't necessarily understood what motivated industry. Okay, so let me tell you a funny story. So we had this paper, it was sort of drafted, we had some numbers in it, we had gotten some initial results, we were comparing a bunch of different database systems, and HBase, one of the ones we were comparing, was extremely slow, like horribly, awfully slow, not scalable, falling down. So we're like, oh, that's interesting. So we thought we should, like, you know, just kind of let the community know that we were working on this and see, hey, you know, if they had any feedback. So we wrote this email to the HBase developer list, which was essentially, hi, we're researchers, we're doing this fun, cool project, we got some numbers, and by the way, your database is super slow. Yeah, they didn't take that so well. Their reaction was actually extremely negative, and we had a lot of very intense email exchanges. And it came down to a couple of things. So one, of course, they had their own numbers sort of demonstrating that their system was awesome, so how dare we show up with different numbers showing that it was not awesome. And secondly, they actually said this, they were sort of upset that a large internet corporation, Yahoo, was coming in and sort of stomping on their beautiful little open source project, okay? And this was actually quite an eye-opening experience for me, because I thought of this as a research project. This is interesting. You know, I'm curious from an academic standpoint which system is better, but at the end of the day, I'm going to go home and go to sleep, and it's okay. But for them, it was like the survival of their project, right? Like, they were trying to get mind share and attention for their open source thing, and get people to contribute to it, get people to use it, and now there's going to be this paper in this big prestigious conference from this large tech giant saying the system was the worst one of all the ones compared. So it was a very sort of existential thing for them. Luckily, it all worked out. So we all got in a room, a conference room at Yahoo, with no windows, if I remember correctly. And sort of worked out our differences, right? So we sort of talked to each other about what we were trying to accomplish, and we helped them understand us, and they helped us understand them. And we actually got some positive value out of this. So one thing is they helped us tune our system, or actually our implementation of HBase. So we had installed HBase, but of course it could be tuned, and the people that implemented it knew how to tune it best. And also, our benchmarks helped them identify some bottlenecks in their code, and they were actually able to relatively easily push a few changes that significantly improved the throughput, okay? And as we talked to them, we kind of figured out why we thought their system was slow and they thought their system was fast, and that was because the benchmarks they were running were primarily scan-oriented. They were talking about Hadoop MapReduce scanning over an entire HBase table, and we were talking about point reads and point writes and serving workloads, that you're going to sort of be doing seeks all over the disk, and they just weren't optimized for that at all. And so we kind of helped to understand that there's different workloads and that their system was good for some and that we could sort of tune it potentially for others. Okay, so since that day, it's been a relatively successful tool. There's support for 50 different database backends. It's widely used as a research experiment framework, which is great. It's also used in industry to actually compare different systems. Working at Google, actually somebody was trying to, you know, run YCSB over a system that I was working on, and they were like, hey, are you, yeah, you're Brian, okay. So that's great. These days, we're not super involved in the open source project. We've moved on to other things, but luckily we have a great team of maintainers that are actually keeping the project up and running, making sure that they take pull requests and they fix bugs and so on and do releases. So that's awesome. All right, my last funny story, as I was putting together these slides, I realized that all of us have worked at Google except for Raghu. So we got to get that guy one day. All right. So just to conclude, this was a very interesting time. We're working in an exciting area. There was these new systems that were coming out, but there wasn't yet a great way to sort of do really high-quality comparisons between different systems. So we lucked out because there was that giant gap. We made it easy for people to measure these systems, which I think is the key to success, to make it easy for people to download and run the tool. And we're just super thankful. You know, we're thankful for the award. We're thankful for the people at Yahoo that helped us run these benchmarks over some of the internal systems. We're thankful to the open source maintainers that keep the tool up and running and keep new things coming into it. And we're super thankful to all of you that happen to have downloaded and used the tool and cited our paper in yours. So thank you very much.
So we do have time for a few questions if people want to ask questions.
Rux, Oksana Jambasho, Columbia. What's the next big benchmark that you think is missing?
Oh, dear. So I don't know about you all, but every time I talk to people, they use the word machine learning in some way or another.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
So I suspect that, at least from my perspective, there's a lot of kind of the same Wild West around it. Like, oh, let's throw machine learning at this and that and the other thing without any real sort of comparison of, are we really sort of, you know, providing application value? So perhaps something there could be useful.
Supreet from UT Austin. Well, a couple of comments, I guess. In terms of the citations, I think we put together the number of like most cited papers, and this is by far the most cited. I think Sharam's numbers are completely off. Google Scholar says like 2,600. So in 2,600, yes. So it's by far the most cited SOC paper ever. So
thanks.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
So another, so we were looking at, so in terms of new workloads, we were looking at GDPR and we wanted to create a new benchmark. And so obviously we looked at YCSB and we said, oh, everything needs to be changed from workloads to metrics to the DB wrappers, to some extent even DBs. And we were bracing up for a huge project, and it turns out that even though we had to touch all four, like less than 2 months for one person, it just was over. So we were like so guilty that like they didn't even deserve a paper for this because it was so easy. So thank you very much for that.
Great.
So, yeah, it just had two comments, no questions.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy that people have found this useful. I mean, we wrote it in a way that we thought would be usable, but we didn't really know at the time. But I'm continually surprised at how often we hear this acronym YCSB. So that's great.
So Supreet said something that I want to reflect on. The numbers I showed you are truly the conservative numbers. They're just based on ACM Digital Library and what it is reporting. And they are way off. I mean, if you actually go do the analysis, maybe a factor of two off. So as far as the numbers are concerned.
But who's counting?
Hi, Zach Zimmerman, UC Riverside. So I have a question regarding, you released this great benchmark, right? What happens when, like, in this scenario, it's still being used, right? But what happens when you release a good benchmark for the time and people maybe still continue to use it after kind of it's hit its prime, and maybe you feel like you don't think that it's that useful to compare against this thing anymore? But people still continue to use it. We have this kind of problem with it's not really a problem, but we have this kind of issue with some of the time series work that my group has done. We have a really nice benchmark suite that we've used, but a lot of people use it in the wrong ways, and you know, kind of they kind of misuse it in ways that it wasn't intended to in the beginning. You know, how do you go about convincing people?
Back.
Yeah, yeah.
Stop holding my thing. Yeah, I mean, this is a real issue. So just to give you another example, so I worked at Google on the Spanner team. Maybe you've heard of Spanner. It's a database system there. It's a relational system with transactions. So it's exactly the opposite of the thing we meant to measure with YCSB. And when they went to provide a cloud version of it, you know, they felt compelled to provide YCSB benchmarks over this thing that was very much not a NoSQL system. So it's definitely happening even today. I think in that case, it's just kind of up to us as members of the community to sort of, like Roxana said, what's the next big thing that we should actually be measuring? And I find that people will use a benchmark if there's nothing else out there, right? Like, that's kind of one of the reasons they used ours, is that there was literally nothing else. And so I suspect that defining either a successor or a new kind of benchmark is the way to go there.
So with that, let's stop and thank Brian and the YCSB team once again.